Welcome to the Frontline Industry Podcast. Every week, we talk with top senior executives to get their advice on positively impacting frontline employees, companies, and customers. On today's episode, People Over Spreadsheets, I talked to Heidi Buskey, transformation leader at Cargill, the largest privately owned company in the U.S. Heidi discusses why she loves manufacturing, how to create a winning culture and community in your company, how losing her best friend at work showed her the power of work relationships, the negative feedback she received early in her career that shaped her forever, and much more. Don't go anywhere. The Frontline Industry Podcast starts right now. Welcome to the Frontline Industry Podcast. My name is Joel, and it's an exciting day because today I'm joined with Heidi Buskey. Heidi is the transformation leader at Cargill Global Protein and Salt. She's been a woman in manufacturing her whole career, having leadership positions in a variety of organizations, including Tyson Foods, Pilgrim's, and of course now Cargill as well. She'll tell us all about that, her passions for manufacturing, why she's still in it after all these years, and what's coming up next for her. But first of all, welcome to the Frontline Industry Podcast, Heidi.
Thanks, Joel. Appreciate you having me, and I'm excited to be here today.
I'm very excited to have you here as well. And so, Heidi, I gave a bit of a background to you, though, but you have spent almost every day of your career in manufacturing. And it's hard to find women who are in manufacturing and leadership positions. It's hard to find folks as passionate as you are for what you do. And I know for those who aren't going to be watching this live, they won't see your smile, but you really are passionate right now, and you really do love the world you're in. And so would you just share a little more about your background, your passions, and why you are so entrenched in the manufacturing world?
Sure. You're absolutely right. I do love what I do. I love being in the manufacturing world, and especially the, protein manufacturing world, especially. Every day in the manufacturing world is a new challenge. Some challenges are easy to solve and some are much more difficult to solve, but it really taps into your creative thinking. It also forces you to constantly be looking for a better way, which is something that just gets me jazzed and excited about everything when it comes to work. So always looking for that better way. Finding a better way to serve our customers, finding a better way to serve our employees. Nothing stays the same. And in manufacturing, you realize that much quicker than you do in lots of other industries. I tend to be a very competitive person. And manufacturing is one of those places where every day you can win at something, right? There's always a win to be found. Sometimes it's a win of the hour. Sometimes it's a win of the day. Sometimes it's, winning in the overall industry. So that drives me to come to work and to continue to think big and find better ways, because I do like to win. And I love the people in the plants make the world go around. We've realized more in the last 2.5 years with COVID that is, not just a figurative saying. They really do make our world go around. And the stories, the backgrounds of the people that work in our manufacturing facilities are amazing. The reason why they come to work every day is always intriguing and heartfelt. It really just taps into my empathetic kind of mother side of who I am and what I love about it.
I love that. And I didn't hear you say, and I'm sure you do love your corporate colleagues as well, but I didn't hear you say that you're in it for them. And I think that's so notable, because a lot of times we do forget how valuable those shop floor employees are, the frontline employees. And like you said, during COVID, we saw such an impact when they weren't there that we realized they really are the most important people in the organization, that folks like yourself wouldn't have a job if they weren't doing their job as well. Can you tell us a little more about this winning idea? Because for you, it's really important, but how do you embed into a culture that's as sizable as Cargill, that is, and the protein and salt divisions are huge, you're global, and your role, I'm sure we'll hear a little more about this, as transformation leader, has to include creating transformation on the front lines of the organization. So how do you embed that Heidi winning mentality into the front lines?
I'm a firm believer that everybody wants to win. Everybody comes to work every day with the anticipation of doing a good job, and meeting the expectations that are put in front of them. So to me, it's important as we continue to find ways to communicate those expectations and let everybody know that we're winning or we have more work to do on that day, that hour. I don't think I'm alone in the love of winning. You know, everybody wants to be successful, and helping everybody understand what piece of success they own in that hour, that day, you know, with that customer that we're making goods for is important. So getting that information to them where they're making decisions on how they do their work to me is absolutely critical to keeping them engaged, keeping them wanting to come back to work the next day, and getting them to also help in finding new ways to win.
Winning is really an important thing. And I think it is embedded in us or inbred as human beings. It is tough, admittedly, when you are in a meat plant. And I've been in many of them, not as many as you by any stretch of the imagination. But, you know, it is hard to think as a person who's, you know, filling up a chub of meat, which is, by the way, is my favorite word in all manufacturing.
Chub.
I think it's just hilarious. Or someone who is, you know, packing off cases of beef. It's a lonely world sometimes, and it doesn't feel necessarily like you're winning or losing. It just kind of feels monotonous, right? And so what sort of leadership at the front lines for supervisors or for plant managers, production managers, folks like that, do you want to see to facilitate that sort of winning culture?
Yeah, I think one of the biggest things for roles that are like that, because they are monotonous, they aren't always, you know, super engaging. In addition to giving them a visual cue as to whether or not they're being successful or not, helping the entire line, the entire plant have a work community, feel like they're a community. You know, everybody wants to come in and feel like they belong there, that they're a part of something that's bigger than just the position or the box that they're, you know, taking from the line and stacking into the pallet. Creating that community, that culture where people care about each other. It's not just about the products that go down the line, but it's keeping each other safe, watching out for each other, you know, understanding if somebody's child had a great big soccer game the night before and asking about that, you know, understanding why everybody comes to work every day. To me is important. It's just as important as giving them those visual cues of winning is creating that community for them to come to every day where they know that people care about them.
I'm reminded of the Gallup Q12, and I'm not sure what your background or history has been with that. Have you done much work with that at all?
I actually did the Gallup poll when I worked for Oscar Mayer several years ago.
Okay. Yeah. So, I mean, I am pretty impacted by the Q12, because I think when you talk about community, it strikes something within me that, you know, when you look at the Q12, and if you're not familiar for those listening with the Gallup Q12, these are the 12 needs that managers can meet to improve employees' productivity. And I won't read them all here for those listening, but many of them revolve around this idea of relationship and of community. You know, my supervisor or someone at work seems to care about me as a person. Someone at work encourages my development. You know, my associates or fellow employees are committed to doing quality work. I have a best friend at work. These are all relational concepts. They're so intrinsically embedded within us as humans that if we're not getting them, it is going to feel monotonous, lonely, and isolating. And so having that community at work, even within a manufacturing plant where maybe it's cold and dreary and frustrating sometimes, can make the biggest difference in the world when it comes to creating that employer of choice environment.
Yeah, I agree. And when I first saw that Gallup and took the Gallup survey, and we saw the results come back with the 12 main indicators, we actually kind of laughed about the best friend at work. We're like, that's so crazy. Nobody comes to work to find their best friends. And then my best friend at Oscar Mayer left. And never before did I feel so alone at work. And all of a sudden it was made real extremely quick that having that best friend at work was extremely important to me. And it really did make a difference on you know, how I showed up at work and how much confidence I brought with me when I came to work.
I reflect on some of the, even the more menial jobs in my career early on. And, you know, for me, I wasn't in the manufacturing space early on, but I was in retail. And so you have that same group of 5, 10, 12, 20 employees that you're with every single day. And they really do become your family. And you really do have relationships with them that can be very authentic and real and deep. You tell them things that you might not even tell your family because you're just in the trenches with them every day. Same thing goes for restaurants. I know restaurant employees are very communal and they have a lot of relationships. It could be really negatively communal as well, where there's a lot of gossip and backstabbing. But that goes in any sort of, you know, group environment. And yet, you know, you're there 8 hours, 10 hours a day with these people. I don't see my family for 8 or 10 hours a day. I see these people. So I think it's a great point. And I'm curious, when your best friend left at work, maybe it's unrelated, but how long was it before you left?
I'm probably a year.
Was that a lonely year for you?
It was a struggle, you know, things that I probably would have been able to manage through and deal with better just didn't work out the way that I feel like they would have had she still been there, which sounds crazy, but it's a real thing.
It really is a real thing. So let's back up a bit and talk a little more about Cargill. So for those who are listening, and there's a whole host of people from hospitality and healthcare and some in manufacturing and all over the world, Cargill is one of those silent giants that I think people don't realize are so mammoth as you guys really are. Can you just give us the high level 1 minute, 2 minute summary of Cargill? Because you guys really are everywhere doing everything in your world.
Yeah, you're right about that. You know, we are, I believe we could say we're still the largest privately held company in the world. We have about 155,000 employees worldwide. We operate in 70 different countries. We're not a new company by any stretch of the imagination. We've been around for 157 years. So we are definitely a silent giant, headquartered out of Wayzata, Minnesota, which is the Twin Cities area. Last year, I think we were around just under $135 billion in annual revenue.
Am I making this up? I just saw you guys post your revenues for recently, and I think you were like $160 billion now?
Yeah, that could be. We just did, it was probably fairly close, and we had a great year, so they may have gone up.
That really is insane. That's a number I can't even like mentally wrap myself around, right? Because you hear a billion and you can't wrap your head around a billion, let alone 160 billion. And so, you guys really do play in every industry, chocolate and...
One of my favorite. I love to visit the chocolate plants.
There is no complaints for me visiting a chocolate plant. I can tell you that
right
now.
They always send you home with defects. It's amazing.
So funny story, and I know this is all about you, but really quickly, I was at a sizable competitor of Cargill's a while back, and I happened to be visiting there on Halloween day. And so I know my family's at home trick-or-treating without me. I was kind of bummed, you know, because it's a memory of my kids. And they said, hey, well, we're going to make you the hero of Halloween. We're going to send you home with some chocolate. I thought, you know, okay, cool. I'll get some, you know, small bag of chocolate or something.
Yeah.
They handed me a 10-pound chocolate bar, which I'm sure you guys make as well in some form. And for those listening who don't know, a lot of times these bars are melted down by smaller chocolatiers and used to make their smaller, you know, morsels or things like that. But I came home with this giant chocolate bar. Let me tell you, I'm 6'2" and not a small guy, but lugging a 10-pound chocolate bar under your arm throughout multiple flights and layovers in a day was exhausting. I got home, gave it to the kids. They loved it. It is still sitting in my kitchen right now on an upper shelf that is probably going bad and I'll never eat it, but it's a talking piece. And so you're absolutely right. It's an amazing environment to be a part of.
That's definitely a rookie mistake, Joel, that you carried it under your arm.
Yeah.
It should have been put in your carry-on. You should have left room.
It was too long.
Because then when you pop the overhead bin, the whole bin smells like chocolate and you're the hero on the plane. Yeah. I still have one of those. It's amazing. We make chocolate covered straw. We make everything chocolate.
Oh my goodness. You don't go home with 10 pounds of meat in your carry on very often. So no,
that does not make you a hero.
No, it doesn't. So you don't see too many women in manufacturing, which I think is a no-brainer, because it's patently obvious when you look around at leadership teams and the makeup of organizations. Why is it that you've stuck it out? You know, in the sense of, I mean, I'm sure it was to a certain degree difficult for you as you worked through your career. And did you have people, mentors above you, folks who kind of gave you direction and again, you were able to maybe leapfrog in your career faster perhaps than you would have on your own? Tell me about how that journey went for you.
Yeah. It hasn't always been easy, but I absolutely love it. And I'm not afraid of the hard work, the crazy hours. I had a, amazing support system at home that really enabled me to be able to do what I loved and to be able to, manage my career. I would absolutely 100% not be where I am today if I didn't have some of the best mentors in the industry guiding me, helping me, supporting me, being tough with me. I am a strong personality, and early on, that was tough. And I got a lot of strong feedback that if I hadn't gotten and I hadn't accepted, I wouldn't be where I am today. And I wouldn't be a leader.
Would you mind? I mean, I'm sure I'm putting you on the spot here, but is there a story that comes to mind with some of that feedback that now that you're removed from it, isn't as painful and you're willing to share publicly?
Yeah. One of the very first times I was in R&D at Oscar Mayer, and I had been an operations supervisor on a retail hot dog line. But I moved over into R&D and started out working on a hot dog project for R&D and went to a plant I had never been at before and was feeling pretty big in my britches. And the test did not go well. And, I felt like, it was my job to make sure everybody there knew that the test did not go well. And when I came back, the feedback was, you can't go to the plant like a bull in a china shop. And I think it was fair. It was 100% fair. There was a lot of frustration. There was, 14, 15 hour days. There were nerves on my end because this was the first test that I was running by myself and wanted it to be successful. I just didn't handle that very well. And getting that feedback from a guy that I still talk to and still would have no problem telling me that exact same thing if it was true again, was pivotal in my career. Had somebody not been willing to invest their time to tell me that, I probably would have, ruined my reputation and been that person that nobody ever wanted to work with again.
It's hard to find the courage to have those conversations on the other end, right? When you're when you have to talk to that person and tell them, "Hey, you screwed up," right?
Yeah.
And doing that with love and doing it with intentionality and saying it for their best, it is a difficult thing to kind of pull yourself up by the britches and decide to do, because it's so much easier to not have that conversation. But like you said, look at you now, and I'm sure you have those same difficult conversations now as a leader, and you're having them knowing that it transformed you, knowing that it made you a better person, and it probably fuels you now to have those conversations with those around you. Can you talk a little more about the team now that you have? And I don't think we've had a transformation leader on our podcast yet, and people are probably scratching their heads, as was I before you told me all about it. What is it that a transformation leader does? What are you trying to accomplish every day? And tell us about the team that you oversee.
Yeah, so it is kind of an interesting title. I've done similar work at other companies, but everyone seems to call it something different, right? It really is around continuous improvement of the organization, continuing to find value opportunities to push us to think differently about the way we manage the business, some of our internal processes, some of the technology that we use. How do we, we're accountable for returning that value back to the organization so that we can continue to stay competitive with customers, offset some of the ridiculous inflation that we see today, right? So our job gets bigger and bigger every time we get a new invoice. it also is you know, on us to return that value so that we can continue to grow and use that money that, you know, we save through efficiencies and finding better ways to do things and invest it back into the business.
So you mentioned inflation. Is that like the number one challenge right now for your business? Or what do you look at as maybe the top three biggest challenges as the global transformation, you know, leader for global protein and salt that you're looking at tackling in the next 12 months?
You know, overall, and I think for the industry, for what we're, you know, working through, inflation is definitely one. Our labor is probably the biggest challenge right now, definitely for us, but also for our industry. I think for a lot of manufacturers out there, that's one of the critical keys, figuring that out and trying to unlock a new labor force, unlock, you know, what is that holy grail that gets laborers to want to come to work every day is huge. And, you know, just the ever-changing consumer and regulatory environment is also a challenge that makes my job challenging and exciting and rewarding all at once.
It's not an industry that, unless you're already in it or you had an introduction to it, that people would necessarily think of to go into for a career, right? I mean, I think a lot of shop floor employees think of themselves as a transitional job and doing this for a little while, but I know a lot of organizations have some very long-standing tenured employees as well. But I think of I have a half-brother and I was adopted. So I got to know him in the last several years. And throughout our conversations, he was looking for a career pivot. And I just saw a part of him that just aspired to be a leader, that loved people, had great people skills, had some slight operations experience already. And I just said, hey, you should go apply for a manufacturing lead or a supervisory role. I think you'd really do well. He's like, manufacturing? Like, I don't know anything about manufacturing. I'm like, yeah, but you know people and you understand people and you speak really well with people and everyone loves you and gets along with you. I think you'd actually enjoy it. Here we are. I don't know. It's been a year and a half later. He loves his job. He's That's doing awesome. That very thing. And so I guess my question to you that comes out of that is, for those who are listening and who have never, I mean, I know we have a lot of folks listening who aren't executives, who are also in frontline roles, in frontline positions. For those who actually might be great at the manufacturing world, but don't realize it yet, what do you look for as a supervisor, a former supervisor yourself? What would you encourage those, who would you encourage to go and look for roles in your industry?
Yeah, you know, I think for me, what I look for, I think you summed it up well. You have to find a way to be able to tap into that team that you lead, find a way to connect with them, find a way to figure out their why, be a real person to them. You know, how do you engage a group of multicultural, employees that may not speak the same language as you? They may not speak the same language as the person who works next to them, but how do you find a way to engage and communicate that common goal, share wins, get through tough days, you know, keeping upbeat? You know, I'm a huge fan of visual management, love visual management. Like, if I could build a plant from scratch up, like from the ground up, it would be completely around visual management. But I often say, you know, we've been practicing visual management long before it was ever a term, just by smiling. Like, that's the single most valuable tool that we have when it comes to visual management is a smile. And it's, you know, one of those that you have to be careful of. Someone like me that gets in my head as I'm walking around with 14 other things going through and what my face shows, remembering that people are watching you as that frontline leader, they respond to that. You also have to have the business side. If you're going to, you know, be a frontline leader, you have to understand, and be willing to look at data. You know, what does the data tell you? How do we continue to get better? That drive to get better every day, not every day is going to be perfect. It's just not, right? That's not the world that we live in.
Right.
Especially in our world where we don't make widgets, right? We don't get to turn the machine on once and let it run for a month and then turn it off and do maintenance, right? So having the patience to deal with those bad days, being willing to look at the data to continually make things better. I also firmly believe that it's our job as leaders to find ways to make the people who are on the lines jobs easier. That's part of what we get hired to do as our skills experience. Mm-hmm. You know, at my level, at, you know, levels, you know, in operations leadership, that's part of what our responsibility to our team members is.
Yeah. A lot of times supervisors tend to live, or everyone a lot of times tends to live a role below what they're actually called to do because they're comfortable with that. They graduated out of that role and now they're elevated. And so they actually know how to do that frontline job as well as or better than the people they're managing. And so they just get in the weeds with them and then do it and don't train them on how to do it better or don't allow them to make mistakes and make them learn through that process or don't live in that leadership level, like you're saying, where they're recognizing their role now isn't to make the meat, it's to make the people making the meat better. And so I hear some Simon Sinek in you with the answering your why or finding their why. Tell me about your why. You know, For Heidi, what gets you going then? What's your why? If you weren't in manufacturing, what would you still be seeking with your why every day?
For me, it's finding that intersection where the people come together with your customer, with the operation and the capabilities that you have, and being the most efficient about that. And then take it one step further and think bigger. I love to think bigger. I love to think about that 3 to 5 year strategic view. What's possible? Like, I understand what we can do today, and that's great, but what is capable? Like, and how do we get there? How do we close that gap?
Yeah.
In the next hour, the next day, the next week, the next year, right? And showing that progress, having something that we can measure ourselves against that will show us, look, we really are getting better and we're moving closer to that goal. We've delivered a new capability. We've hit this consumer trend dead on and our new growth is, you know, exceeding expectations. Those are the sorts of things that, you know, really get me excited. And I love to celebrate that with the people who make it happen, which is the frontline workers. You know, nobody in corporate touches that product before it goes to the actual customer itself. You know, a spec is a file in the system. A P&L is a spreadsheet, right, in a system. But our frontline are the people who are actually making the products for our customers. They are so important to everything that we do every single day.
So pull yourself out of your role now. You've finished your career. At least you decided to take a step away from manufacturing. You're now traveling the world, giving keynote addresses to colleges or universities or organizations. You're at PAC Expo on the stage talking about stuff in Chicago or Las Vegas. What would you talk about? What would you choose if the world was your oyster to go and just share passionately about in those environments?
I think it would be about the importance of being vulnerable as a leader at all points of your career. If I hadn't been vulnerable in those early years, vulnerable enough to take that feedback, I wouldn't be where I am today. You know, in the last year, I've had some pretty significant challenges in my personal life, and being vulnerable enough to say, I need some help. I need some help at work. I need some help at home.
Yeah.
You know, was huge. I wouldn't have made it through if I hadn't been willing to say, I can't do this all by myself. And for someone like me, that's extremely challenging because I'm extremely independent. I can kind of be a little bit of a control freak. So, you know, being vulnerable is not easy. It, you know, there's several times in my career too, where raising my hand to say, I'm interested in that role, or I want to put my hat in the ring, felt like I was making myself extremely vulnerable to being told no, or to failing. Mm-hmm. And had I not been willing to take some of those risks, I also wouldn't be where I am at today because I wouldn't have the breadth of experience to be a strong business partner.
That's a great answer. Vulnerability just seems to be missing so often, especially as you work your way up in organization on the hierarchies. I mean, I don't know what it is. Maybe it's a pride thing. Maybe it's a fear of failure, where if people think I'm not, you know, as confident as I am, they'll think less of me or whatever it is. I'm sure there's pressures there, but man, vulnerability is contagious, right? You share something about that you're going through, and suddenly everyone around you is like, oh my gosh, thank goodness someone else is struggling too, right?
Yeah. And I am very fortunate. You know, this is one of the things that I absolutely love about Cargill, is that vulnerable leadership and servant leadership are not uncommon. Like, my current manager is probably one of the best people in the world. I swear,
oh, wow. You know,
and so they make it easy to be vulnerable with, because you understand that they care more about you as a person than they do about your numbers and your results. And that makes it easier. I think having more leaders like that, that have that empathy is not a leadership weakness. In my opinion, it's a leadership must.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah. Fortunately, that's one thing I love about the meat industry. I have worked with some of the best people you could ever ask to work for.
That's a great word. And I think we'll end it then with one final question. And that is, what's something that you believe, Heidi, that if everyone else believed too, would make this world a better place?
That we need to invest more time in knowing more about our people and why they come to work. I can't say it enough. We need them to understand how important they are to every bit of success that we all share, whether it's at the line level, the plant level, the total corporation, even our customers. You know, connecting our frontline team with customers, and so that they take pride in watching our customers win. They, you know, when they go through the drive-through, they know that they made something that they're about to feed their family. You know, connecting that is huge, and then protecting it. Not letting people come in and, you know, tear that down or lead without that sort of caring compassion.
Well, you certainly have a lot of that caring and compassion yourself, and that you just hear it in your voice, the empathy that you do feel. And I'm so grateful to know you, Heidi, and I'm so grateful for the time we could spend today. I know you could be doing a whole lot of other things, but doing this podcast only came to your attention recently. And so I thank you for taking the time to be on it with me. Any final words, things that you would leave those listening when it comes to great leadership or best practices that you would hope that to see others around you do more of?
Just take the time. It's not always all about the numbers, right? In this day and age, when every bit of talent is important to your business, take the time to know your people, check in on your people. It's more than just a spreadsheet.
Yeah. And when you spend that time with those people, the numbers end up following. Time and time again. Well, Heidi, thank you so much for being with me today. For those listening, thank you for listening to the Frontline Industry Podcast. Go out there, get to know your people, understand their why, and help them achieve it. And I'm sure you'll see the numbers follow as well. We'll see you next time.
This podcast is proudly sponsored by Unison. Put your best team everywhere and create a strong community and employer of choice experience for your frontline associates. Being around like-minded people who are trying to accomplish the same things as you are is energizing and motivating, just like our community of listeners. You're part of a movement of individuals who believe in the power of people and the potential they have to do incredible things. And if I'm describing how you feel, but you're not subscribed yet, hit the button and subscribe to take the journey together, and I'll see you next time.